This podcast is brought to you by ClearBridge Investments. Meet an evolving economy confidently with ClearBridge Active Equities, the foundation of a resilient portfolio. ClearBridge, a Franklin Templeton company. Go to clearbridge.com to learn more.
Please stay tuned for important disclosure information at the conclusion of this episode.
Hi, and welcome to The Long View. I'm Christine Benz, Director of Personal Finance for Morningstar.
And I'm Jeff Patak, Global Director of Manager Research for Morningstar Research Services.
Is there a retirement crisis in the U.S., and what role does government have in improving the system? What's the current status of the fiduciary rule? These are just some of the topics that our guest today, Aaron Shapiro, obsesses over. Aaron is Morningstar's Director of Policy Research. In that role, he and his team conduct research on various matters of public policy and formulate views on policy proposals under consideration by Congress and regulatory bodies. Aaron has testified before Congress on how to improve retirement security, and he has an inside view of how Washington works. Before venturing into the private sector, he was a senior analyst in the U.S. Government Accountability Office. Aaron was also on Investment News' 2019 list of 10 most influential millennials. Aaron is a passionate advocate for improving the financial system so that it works better for investors of all incomes and ages, and we're thrilled to have him here today. Aaron, thank you so much for being here.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
Aaron, let's just start by digging into your biography a little bit. What got you interested in policy? You were a history major at Grinnell College, but then went on to get your master's in public policy at Johns Hopkins. What motivated you to do that?
So my first real job after college, and this was I didn't realize at the time, but it was an amazing experience, was working for the then Speaker of the New Jersey General Assembly, Albio Sirius, who's now a congressman. And I just got to see how the legislative sausage was made. And I also realized I didn't know anything. And then also, I didn't have the tools. I mean, I had a history degree so I could synthesize arguments and, you know, write fairly well. But I didn't have the kind of quantitative chops to really, you know, dig in and do analysis. And I was lucky that my parents forced me to take a bunch of math at Grinnell, so I was able to get into, you know, one of these MPP programs and make the most of it. The other thing was it got me interested in retirement security because I would see, and I guess it's been a long enough ago I can reveal this, and I'd see people sitting around kind of thinking, okay, we have this huge deficit. Oh, I know, we'll change from an entry age normal actuarial valuation to a projected unit credit valuation. Oh, we've wiped out several billion dollars in our ARC payment for the pension this year, and great, we closed the budget deficit. I mean, so that, you know, that was like, you know, this arcane language that I wanted to understand, and it got me really interested in sort of that aspect of retirement security.
Can you talk about what policy means at Morningstar? It's a relatively new subject matter area for us, which you're leading very capably. But I think to some of our listeners, they wouldn't be familiar of what policy means at Morningstar. Is it lobbying? Is it us taking other positions?
Yeah, absolutely. So it's definitely not lobbying. So I'll start with that. Maybe it'd be helpful for me to just say really quickly what policy means for investors, and then I'll kind of flow into what it means at Morningstar. So, you know, I think policy really drives and dictates a lot of what ends up happening to investors. So, I mean, in the absence of 26 USC Section 401 subsection K, you know, how many people would be investing on their own for retirement? I mean, I'd say not many, or a comparable policy. And for that matter, without the Investment Company Act, would people have any confidence in mutual funds? And we know the answer to that because people tried to form them before the Investment Company Act and didn't go so well. So, you know, policy is sort of like the water that we swim in, and we don't notice it until it gets a little murky or things start changing. You know, in terms of what that means at Morningstar, so what I want to do is make sure that when we have an important perspective, a unique data, where we're, you know, really qualified to comment, that we weigh in and make ourselves a resource to policymakers. And so I've spent the last 3 years trying to build our brand at the agencies and on the Hill so that they come to us and say, hey, we're thinking about doing this thing. You guys have this really good perspective on what happens. You sit on a pile of useful data, and you've got people with 30-plus, you know, years of experience, you know, thinking about how to do what's best for investors. What do you guys think? Or do you have any research papers you can provide? And the other thing I probably should have led with this is, so we use a pretty common framework for evaluating policy, which is we look at current conditions. We have a criteria, and then we look at the cause and effect of any mismatch between those things. A criteria is always what's best for investors, right? What's going to make the most sense for investors? And then if we can do a normative analysis where we can, you know, run the numbers and come up with an answer, we'll do it, and we'll share that with policymakers, and we'll advocate for investors, but without crossing the line into, you know, lobbying for some narrow Morningstar interest.
So that was a related question. Is Morningstar obviously has business interests in some of the areas that policies touch, and so how do you ensure that you and your team, when you're formulating conclusions about the direction that you think policy should go, how do you sort of shield your independence from Morningstar's business interests?
I have to tell you, it ends up being pretty easy because of the culture here. I do chair a policy council, and we make sure that as we're developing recommendations, we go through a formal process where we ask ourselves, what would be best for investors and what evidence do we have to support that position for whatever it is? You know, anything from tagging data and, you know, extensible business reporting language to quarterly reporting to regulation best interest, whatever it is, right? We start with that, what would be best for investors. It has never been the case where I've had to tell somebody, hey, I think we need to come back and refocus on the investor. What usually happens is, you know, I'm kind of off in my own world thinking things through, and somebody will say, yeah, but we're putting the investor first as we think about this, right? And so there's a culture here that makes it pretty easy to have that kind of independence. And everyone that I work with understands that that's what we're trying to do, and, you know, understands that they have expertise or data or perspective, but it's based on what do we think would be the best policy for helping people invest, reach their financial goals, save for retirement, whatever it is.
And so best for investors, two different people can come to very different conclusions about what is best for investors. I mean, perhaps, you know, one of the more manifest examples of that is suitability versus a fiduciary standard, right? And I think that proponents of each of those positions would suggest that it's best for the investor. And so when you are working with your team and trying to formulate sort of what is best for investors in this particular policy area, I mean, is there a certain sort of system or set of protocols that you're using to make sure that you're upholding the standard you want to?
Yeah, absolutely. So what we don't do is we don't try to make a values-based argument. You know, we don't try to make an argument that says the government should be doing this or shouldn't be doing that. What we try to do is stick to an analysis where we can, you know, look at the facts and say this will be the effect of this policy. And because our North Star is what's best for the investor, because we always develop a criteria of what will be best for the investor, you know, if we analyze something and say, you know, the effect of this policy will be investors will have access to less actionable and comparable information, well, that's something I'm comfortable putting in a comment letter or putting in one of our periodic white papers. But if it's more ambiguous and it's sort of a question of a philosophy of sort of, you know, where regulations should stop and start, I mean, we're just not really equipped to weigh in on that. We want to be, you know, totally fact-based, and we want to make sure that we have the data and the analytic techniques and the context to support a fact-based analysis that says, you know, if you pursue this policy, we think that investors will probably save, you know, this amount of money. We think, the way the fiduciary rule is structured, fund flows will probably switch this amount, and this is why we think it, you know, or we can look at a regulatory impact analysis an agency has done and said, you know, we've tried to replicate this analysis and we get a different answer. But those are all, you know, very fact-based approach to policymaking as opposed to sort of, it's wonderful to have a philosophy or an opinion about the role of government, but that's not what I do in this role.
What do you think, you know, one of the things that's been quite striking in the U.S. market is that by some measures, investors have been racing ahead of policy in the sense that, for instance, there's been very, very strong demand for low-cost passives in particular. Some who work on investors' behalf are already, you know, sort of enshrining a fiduciary standard into the work that they do. So I guess the question is, should policy lead the investor, or is it more normal for the investor to lead us to a certain standard that's then codified by policymakers?
That's a great question. I mean, I think I'm gonna answer it by saying both. I mean, one place where you really see the investors driving policy is on shareholder resolutions, right? Because they're saying, hey, we want more information on ESG or whatever it is. And companies will often say, oh, yeah, you know what? Actually, you don't even have to put that to a proxy vote. Like, we'll just go do it. And then regulators say, sounds like this information is meeting the standard of what a reasonable investor wants. We've got all these shareholder resolutions. You know, everyone should really probably just provide it. So you see investors leading policymakers, I think. I think for less sophisticated investors, if you take a big step back, look at the high-level context. We've set up a system where everybody is transitioning, almost everybody's transitioning into a defined contribution plan. And that means that people either need to develop expertise or they need advice from people who have expertise and can help them navigate that system. And, you know, quite frankly, it's economically inefficient to say that everybody who is a doctor or hangs drywall or whatever it is needs to also be an investment expert. And I think that's where you see policymakers needing to lead to ensure there are some protections and ensure the system works. And I think policymakers with a long view have a huge incentive to do this. I mean, if you think of the macroeconomics of having a group of people that will reach retirement and not have any money, they become a destabilizing force on the economy. And so it's really in government's long-term interest to make sure that we have a system that empowers and protects people who are in a system where they have to save and make some decisions for retirement, but they're going to rely on kind of a public-private partnership to get that done.
The fiduciary rule has come up a couple of times already. Let's talk about – let's catch everybody up who hasn't been super plugged into this issue. What's going on with this fiduciary rule currently? The SEC has this best interest mm-hmm. proposal. Let's just kind of do some stage setting around that.
Sure. Well, it's sort of a mess. So, of course, the Department of Labor's rule was vacated by the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals. And so that rule in its entirety is dead. But the department still has the authority to promulgate a revised rule for Title I of ERISA. So let me break that down a little. And that would be, you know, mostly just 401k plans. And in fact, actually on their long-term regulatory agenda, it says that they will promulgate such a rule. I mean, one of the interesting things is when they went out and said, hey, the old five-part test for whether or not you are a fiduciary no longer applies, you know, there's a much a different standard and many more people are going to be fiduciaries as they're giving advice. A lot of companies said, okay, well, I'm going to represent myself as a fiduciary. And they continue to represent themselves as fiduciaries. But when the rule was struck down, the prohibited transaction exemption that would allow these companies to engage in otherwise prohibited transactions while being fiduciaries also got tossed. And so, you know, we want these financial services firms to step up and say, yeah, we're fiduciaries, and we want to give them a path to do that. And I think so the DOL will ultimately have to do something. Now, the common wisdom is they're going to wait until the SEC finalizes their rule. The SEC's rule is not a fiduciary standard, and it's also not a uniform standard. What it does is it elevates the standard of conduct for broker-dealers. And the argument people are having is, to what extent does it elevate it above FINRA's suitability standards? And I don't have a great answer to that, and I don't think anybody else does either. It does seem to me to be a higher standard in that it talks about the need to mitigate certain financial conflicts of interest, but it doesn't have any bright lines, right? And the Department of Labor's rule was principles-based, but also had some pretty clear bright lines that forced the creation of a variety of new products, T-shares and probably ultimately clean shares, in order to avoid conflicted payments from asset managers to broker-dealers. There's nothing like that in regulation best interest. I think also, and I'm sure people groan when they hear this, but there's going to be litigation, I think, on regulation best interest because the section of Dodd-Frank they're using says, like, you should promulgate a uniform standard. And they didn't do that. And so, you know, I think it's very likely that some of the consumer advocates are going to sue them if they don't change the final rule. So we'll see where they go. You know, what we'd like to see there, a lot of this comes down to rollovers. People are in a retirement plan. Their employer is a fiduciary. It's a very, very, very high standard of conduct. When they roll over, it's a very different standard of conduct. That was what the Department of Labor was reacting to in the first place. And we'd like to see some explicit mention of rollovers in regulation best interest, sort of clear do's and don'ts for broker-dealers recommending the rollover. And, you know, it's in the preamble to the regulation, but it's not actually in the regulation. The preamble says, like, oh, this applies to rollovers, but it doesn't really get into the, you know, what your affirmative obligation is. Now, there's a third wrinkle to this, which is the states. So New Jersey, I don't know, last week, 2 weeks ago, proposed a fiduciary standard that would be a uniform standard there. I think New Jersey, you know, I used to work in New Jersey politics. I think they have, you know, 8 million, there's about 8 million people there. So I'm not sure that's enough people to sort of push the changes that you need to see at a sort of industry-wide level to necessarily meet that standard the way that it's envisioned. It's a very tough standard. Doesn't have a private right of action, though, so there's no – doesn't set up additional litigation. Nevada has also proposed a standard which does set up an additional litigation. I think there's even fewer people in Nevada. The interesting thing will be if one of the big states gets involved, right? So if California says, okay, we're going to have our own fiduciary standard, that could really be the states leading on this. So that's kind of where we're at right now, and I think things are – you know, it took a long time to reach a brief point of certainty with the final DOL fiduciary rule, and then a few months for that to be vacated. And I think there's just sort of a lot of different strands in the air right now between DOL's existing authority and their regulatory agenda, where the SEC is, and what the states may do.
How do you feel about states coming at some of these issues in a piecemeal way? Like, if there's some big issue that needs to be addressed, such as people working for small employers don't have good plans, and then states start to address that, isn't it just messier than it needs to be?
It is. And, you know, we have a paper coming out on 529s, which are state-run, and it's quite a patchwork. And, you know, some people have access to good 529s, people have access to bad ones. I mean, when you have these patchwork of state programs, can be a problem. You know, in terms of auto IRAs, we've supported that policy at a state level because, look, the feds aren't doing anything.
Let's talk about what auto IRAs
are.
Sure,
absolutely. Yeah. So these are programs where the states are going to automatically enroll anybody who doesn't have a retirement plan at work, or anybody who doesn't have a retirement plan at work for employers who meet some qualifications, in an IRA that the state will run. You know, over the long run, you'd like to see that at a national level. I mean, having a patchwork of state regulations, whether it's for automatic enrollment in an IRA or for standards of conduct for advisors, is not optimal. It's difficult for large businesses to navigate, and it means you have varying levels of protection for different people. Also, these programs tend to become entrenched. They can have their own centers of gravity, right? There's like local political players who benefit from them and don't want to give them up because their face is on the literature or whatever it is. And, you know, so that is a concern. But to the extent that we've seen so much gridlock at the federal level, we know that retirement security for people who don't have access to a plan at work is really compromised. You know, I think it's good the states are stepping up. And the other thing is, right, I mean, everyone always has to say this when they talk about state policy, so I'll say it. The states are the laboratories of democracy. And we're getting some interesting results from Oregon's experiment with automatically enrolling people in a retirement plan. Right? We can see what the opt-out rates are. We can see how well tolerated they are. Pretty soon we'll see what happens as people switch jobs. So, you know, we'll learn something, and that might enhance an eventual federal solution. But I would hope these things build towards a federal solution ultimately, because it can be kind of a mess.
Do you think it takes crisis or failure for federal policymaking to work in the concerted way it should?
Right now, probably. And you know, I think that's one of the things that's always emphasized in the public policy literature are these, let's call them, focusing events that force policymakers into some kind of a response. You know, retirement security and even investing policy has historically been one of these things. And one of the reasons I like doing it at GAO is it was one of these things that was really bipartisan. It continues to be bipartisan. There's legislation moving through the House right now that in various forms has gotten unanimous support among Democrats and Republicans at a committee level in both the House and Senate. And so we're hopeful that that will become law. And we can dive into that a little bit later if you like. But so retirement security has been an area where you might see a policy response even without, you know, a crisis. And we can also unpack whether there really is one or to the degree that there is one. But it's not – there won't be an event someday where everyone says, oh, my God, there's this crisis. It's a very slow-moving ship. And so in concert with the fact that this has traditionally been bipartisan, one can hold out hope that there would be, you know, some solution before we really have before this slow-moving ship, you know, crashes. And we have a lot of people who have not saved sufficiently during their working lives reaching retirement. As like a broader observation, the other way that government can work effectively is when elections aren't competitive, which I know is something that sounds ridiculous or cynical, but I think it's quite true. Right now, we just have a very competitive electoral environment. So, you know, either party thinks they can win the Senate, either party thinks they can win the House. This cycle, either party is going to think they can win the White House. What that means is you have almost no incentive to cooperate if you're in the minority party, right? Because if you cooperate, you give the patina of bipartisanship to something. Sure, you might get your policy priorities in it, but you've given the majority an argument for why they should be reelected. And you don't want to do that in a situation where things are competitive. And we have a system that relies on cooperation. And so that's what's led to this gridlock. And so I think there's two things. There's like absolute crisis where people just demand some kind of response. Or there's you know, we've had periods of time in the U.S. where at least House elections were basically uncompetitive. I'm not advocating for that from like a little democracy perspective, but from a policymaking perspective, it made it a lot easier to do bipartisan stuff because the minority party would figure, hey, the only way I'm going to get any of my policy priorities in practice is to cooperate with these guys. And I'm not going to, you know, we're down 100 seats. We're not winning the House next time anyway. And so it denationalizes the political environment. It makes it much more local. Also just makes it much more transactional. You know, maybe you figure I'll give you my vote in exchange for, you know, dredging the river or something. So that's sort of where we're at right now. I know that was a much longer answer to your question, but just to kind of fill out the context there.
So you mentioned a couple of times this idea of a retirement crisis, and I sometimes can't believe that people even debate whether there is when you look at certain data points like the fact that you've got a lot of people with nothing saved for retirement. So let's talk about that, how you assess the data about retirement preparedness and what they say to you about retirement preparedness.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think the first thing is that the proponents of the narrative that there's a retirement crisis, and I think, I don't know if crisis is quite the right word, but whatever it is, there's a real problem that merits a policy response to me. But I think the proponents of that point of view have done themselves some damage by citing statistics that you sort of peel back the onion on and they don't look quite right. So one thing you'll hear a lot is half of people have no retirement savings. And that's possibly true on its face, although different surveys and different data sources will give you different answers. So it's probably closer to like one third. I mean, I would say that that's unacceptable, but you know, it's probably a little less. Then you peel that back and you think, okay, well, then there's a bunch of people who have really high replacement rates from Social Security. Then there's a bunch of people who don't have any retirement savings, but they still have a defined benefit plan, more in the public sector than the private sector. But there are a lot of these people out there. And so I think that statistic is pretty easy to debunk. And the people who want to say, hey, there's no problem here, we'll seize on that. You know, that said, there are a lot of people who have retirement savings who do not have nearly enough retirement savings. There are a lot of people with defined benefit plans that were, you know, hard frozen 15 years into their career. Well, that benefit doesn't inflation adjust. It's based on their lower earning years typically, if it's a typical formula. And well, now they have no DC savings because they thought they were in a pension and they've got to like struggle to catch up. And probably that pension freeze was coincident with you know, a job change or a company struggling financially. So, I mean, you know, when you start peeling things back, I think what you see is that the sort of really big scary headline statistics are probably not quite right when you add some context, but there are a lot of people who are slipping through the cracks. And if you look at a demographic level, women, at least historically, so the women who are going to be retiring, much more likely to have dropped out of the workforce for some period of time. So they're not going to have all their quarters for Social Security. Oh, by the way, they live longer. They haven't saved as much. So we know that's a group that really has not done as well with the retirement system that we have. You peel back a little bit further, you know, people who are, you know, really poor have high Social Security replacement rates, but sort of the next quintile up, Social Security replacement rates are not that good. Savings are not very high. People have some savings, but probably not enough. So I think there are a lot of people who've been left behind by the kind of fragmented system that we have. You know, I don't want to get too far into debate about whether it's a crisis or an ongoing challenge or whatever. And I think some of the headline numbers are wrong. I mean, they're wrong if you have any context. But once you get that context, it doesn't look like that great a picture either. So I think that's where a lot of that debate is coming from.
I mean, what do you think the standard that we as a society should be aspiring to when it comes to retirement readiness and retirement security? I mean, I would imagine that's a point of orientation for you and your team when you're thinking about what is the policy facet of ensuring those things. And so how do you arrive at that conclusion?
Yeah, so we take it as a given, right? And that's why we always start with sort of criteria condition. I mean, we take it as a given that the criteria should be people should be able to sustain their standard of living that they had during their working lives in retirement. And so, you know, there'll be some replacement rate that's a little bit lower than their working life income because they're no longer saving. You know, hopefully they're not supporting children. They've paid off their house, whatever it is. But basically sustaining a standard of living through retirement. They don't have commuting expenses. And that's, you know, that's why I'm pretty sanguine about, you know, people for whom Social Security is a 90% replacement rate, because I don't think the goal of retirement policy would be to give people a dramatically higher standard of living in retirement. I think we as a society want to have a retirement system that sustains a standard of living. I don't think there's a lot of disagreement on that point. So that's where we start. And, you know, when you start to see people and you know, there's all kinds of nuance to this. It's true that replacement rates, I think especially for upper income people, you know, that could be a little misleading, but I'm not too concerned about upper income people, most of whom are probably saving enough, although I'm sure some aren't, Christine. But you know, but that's our starting point for that kind of analysis.
And so maybe ignoring some of the terminology around is it a crisis, is it not a crisis? I mean, by that standard, How would we assess the overall state of readiness among those that are in retirement or approaching it?
I mean, the interesting thing is, of the cohort that is in retirement, right now we don't see, either from administrative tax data or from longitudinal studies, I mean, we don't see some large crisis of people running out of money. But I think that's because this generation was much more likely to have defined benefit plans, and also because they haven't been in retirement for that long. And so, you know, I think we'll start to see that percolating up through the data as the boomers move through retirement. I mean, none of the boomers yet have faced longevity risk, which is, I suppose, a technocratic way of saying none of them have faced the prospect they might live an unusually long period of time. We have very poor policy response to protecting people from that eventuality. So, you know, I think you're going to start seeing that in the data. But when critics of the retirement crisis narrative say, you know, look, we don't see people running out of money, it is true. I mean, you really can't find – you can certainly find those examples anecdotally, but you don't see a huge problem of that in the data.
Well, how would you even see that, though, is a question. Like, how would you know if someone ran out of money and didn't just move in with the kids or something like that?
So there's two big surveys that we have that are longitudinal, and so we'll be tracking those people, we meaning of University of Michigan and the RAND Corporation, which run these things.
Okay.
So we do have two really high-quality data sources that aim to look at that and do look at that right now. And then we have administrative tax data. So one of the things is you can see there is a delta between what people say they have and then what they are withdrawing from their IRAs and paying taxes on. And presumably the tax data is the reliable. I mean, nobody's over-reporting their income and paying extra taxes. So those are the two things that will throw up a red flag, the longitudinal survey design and the administrative tax data. And unfortunately, the IRS, yeah, they view their mission as collecting taxes. There's sort of a joke in policy circles that you know you can fill in any question you have with Swedish administrative data because the Swedes are very good at making this widely available. We're not, but we have enough that we'll be able to detect when this is happening. I think you'll also probably see you know you don't want to do policy by anecdote, but I think you'd see a lot more anecdotal evidence bubbling up as well.
So one thing that we've talked about in the past is this bifurcation where if you work for a large employer, chances are you have a decent plan to save in, you may be matched at a decent level, and then things really fall off for smaller employers where plans might be high cost, matching might not be as good. Let's talk about kind of fixing that gulf between very good and very poor plans.
Yeah, I mean it's interesting. You know, John Reckenthaler and I put out a paper a couple of years ago, and you know we observed that we really do have a two-track retirement system. This is a system that I think not only does it work well, it works really well if you are lucky enough to work for a large employer that is offering a plan. Most of those employers are quite innovative. They've been pioneers on auto enrollment. We've seen fees fall every year. We've seen target date funds get a lot more sophisticated. We've seen the introduction of managed accounts and other qualified default investments that are really going to help people. And what they've done is they've made things automatic, they've made them high quality, and they've really given people a good chance at having a successful retirement. Small employers are busy keeping the lights on, right? I mean, you know, they're busy trying to make payroll. If they offer a benefit, it's probably health benefits. Maybe they get around to a retirement benefit and it's not consuming a ton of their time and the retirement plan probably doesn't look good. It was, you know, sold to them by whomever. And so one policy idea that's been kicking around for a long time is always phrased as let small employers band together. It's not quite right. You don't really want them all getting together and being like a co-op board and, you know, it's a little different what the solution would actually look like. But it is allowing a pooled plan provider to market a larger retirement plan to small employers so that it has the AUM, the participants, just the size to become more sophisticated so that there's a real fiduciary at the center of this. So this legislation that is in the SECURE Act and also the Retirement Enhancement and Savings Act, so the House version and the Senate version, would set up a system where these pooled plan providers could go around and say, hey, join my plan. And the hope is that those will be a much higher quality, have some of the features we see in larger plans, drive down cost a little bit. I'm not sure how much administrative savings can really be wrung out of this, but we'll see. And there's a lot of hope around that. So I think that's one possibility. I mean, the other thing is having some kind of auto 401k system. The states are doing auto IRAs, but the chairman of Ways and Means in the last session, when he was in the minority, now he's in the majority, had kicked around this idea. He even drafted legislation that would automatically enroll people in a 401k that would be similarly centrally managed for a lot of small employers. So I think there's like different policy responses that could help narrow that gap.
One thing we've talked about internally is how great the Thrift Savings Plan for federal workers is, and in some ways really kind of a model for what a retirement plan should look like. So what about the idea of sort of federalizing some sort of plan along those lines?
So I have a little conflict of interest here because I was a government employee, still have a lot of money in the Thrift Savings Plan. It's funny. Marco Rubio kicked that around. I mean, he has it in his book that was his like campaign book. That was one of the ideas. I never heard him talk about it on the campaign trail, but I mean, and I've heard Democrats talk about this as well. So I'll tell you, I personally don't think this is a great idea because I mean, I think it's great that there's sort of a model that other people can aspire to. There are a couple of features of the Thrift Savings Plan that I think suggest to me that opening it up widely could be a problem. The first is, although the costs look very low, some of them are eaten by the agencies in a way that you don't see on those, right? So it would be slightly more expensive, although still quite a good deal. I mean, I'm not trying to minimize that. The second thing is, their sort of equivalent of a stable value fund is what's called the government G fund. It buys special securities that are issued by the Treasury. This is like an okay deal for taxpayers. It works at its current scale. I don't think you'd want that to be too big, and it can empower some fairly bad behavior around the debt ceiling. So without going way into the weeds on this, there's this unique fund that I don't think can be replicated at any bigger scale than it's at right now. And that's one of the five funds that's in there. And then finally, there's four funds. They're all index funds. They're all run by the same manager. I think it's probably not great if everything is run through exactly the same strategy with exactly the same manager. And then, of course, there's the politics of this, which are terrible. I mean, the industry would not respond well to everybody being put into a single plan. And I think that some of the arguments I just made, I think, are pretty fair around that. And that said, I think it's really good that it's a model. I think it should be a model for some of the government plans. I mean, I look at some of these 403B plans, and I mean, there's some atrocious stuff in there. Some state 457s or 403Bs, so these are state-run plans. They're not quite ERISA covered. Some of them are quite good. Some of them are not. I mean, they should look at the Thrift Savings Plan and try to replicate something similar. But I think sort of the idea of opening it up. I do think it's sort of hard to scale. And then if I put on my political hat, it just doesn't seem all that likely.
Should there be guardrails, though, around 401ks just in terms of, like, what the maximum allowable expenses that could be charged, something like that?
I think if you look at our experience, I don't think that's necessary. I mean, fees have come down a lot.
True.
There's been a lot of enforcement through the plaintiff's bar, which I think probably does chill innovation a little, but has overwhelmingly – I mean, it's not a popular thing to say, but it's overwhelmingly been a good thing for the plan participants, right? I mean, fees have just come down a lot. The plan sponsors know that they have to pay attention to what they're putting in the plans. I think any kind of bright line I could see it in other markets. I mean, we cover markets I don't want to throw any of the other countries under the bus. We cover markets where the average expense ratio in a fund is like 200 basis points and, have these built-in trailers and stuff. And, there you might say, hey, there needs to be a hard cap. The state auto IRAs, interestingly, have capped at 75 bips. And I think it's actually going to create a bit of a challenge for them as they try to get scale. And if their mission is to bring retirement security to their citizens and that ends up being through a multiple employer plan because employers say, this is a good thing for me to think about. I don't really want to use this auto IRA. I'm going to do something else. Well, they've kind of handicapped themselves in that they have this sort of bright line that they can't cross. Obviously, it's something I haven't thought about that deeply because I think when you're looking at average expense ratios for active funds that are on an asset-weighted basis going towards 50 basis points, it just doesn't seem like we have a huge problem there. I think some of the small plans probably do, but I think the solution to that is to get them in a more professionally managed, larger plan where there's a bunch of employers, where the pool plan provider is a named fiduciary, and there'll be all the right incentives in place. I hope. I mean, I think there'll be the right incentives.
I mean, do you think that the very fragmented system that we have today that you've been describing, for all of its merits, that it maybe discourages participation given its complexity, and that if we were to move to a simpler sort of framework of the sort that Christine described, that while there would be some things that we'd have to manage off, it might induce greater participation and maybe help some savers in a way that, they can't help themselves today?
Yeah. I mean, you would never want to design the system we have if you were starting from scratch, right? I mean, this is a system that comes basically, as far as I can tell, out of, you know, wage controls from World War II. I mean, there were people who had pensions beforehand, but and, you know, frankly, the 401k aspect of this is sort of an accident. I mean, it was intended to be supplemental. And, you know, that's why ERISA doesn't contemplate there being $10 trillion in IRAs. So those are supposed to be supplemental too. And the 401k is added in 1981 because Johnson & Johnson wanted to have a tax privilege supplemental savings plan. Incidentally, they still have an active defined benefit plan. So they have kind of stuck with their original plan. And so, yeah, I mean, I think like a simple answer would be, yeah. I mean, you might want to design a system from scratch that looked very different. You know, to me, the fragmentation, the biggest problem that it creates is on the drawdown side, because what you have is a regulation of the insurance companies who might be able to provide a certain amount of longevity protection. That's what they have in their portfolio. It balances their life insurance side of their portfolio. They're regulated at state level under one set of standards of conduct by a different regulator from the retirement plans, which are regulated by the Department of Labor. I mean, I think that's the biggest sort of problem with fragmentation. The other thing, I mean, just to backtrack a little bit, is businesses that offer good retirement plans, you know, you would think that they would want to say, you know what, I'm fine with not doing this. Let's delink it. Let's do what they do in Australia and just have like a superannuation system that is completely portable, and my whole job as an employer is just to connect you with that system. And they don't want to do that. I mean, they have pride in the plans they've created. They may use them as a retention device, you know, having, you know, 2-year cliff vesting or 3-year cliff vesting, whatever it is, or some kind of phase in. They're proud of what they've done, and they actually want to continue to do it for the most part. You know, and then people who have access to a good plan really like it. And so I think it's not that dissimilar from what you see on the healthcare side, where would you design a system that was totally pegged to employers? I mean, nobody else has, but I can't see really the policy merits in doing it. But you have a system that, you know, hundreds of millions of people literally really like, and that has a lot of business interests invested in it. So I guess I'm more focused on how do we make changes. I wouldn't say at the margins, but within the fundamental framework that we have. But yeah, I mean, right? If I were king, you said like, make the retirement system better, it would look like what Christine has been alluding to, not like what we've drifted into, for sure.
Let's talk a little more about drawdown, because I think that there's a lot that's suboptimal about, okay, you're 68, here's your money, go have at it, figure it out. How can we address that? You mentioned that potentially annuities could be one piece of the puzzle, but there are sort of regulatory impediments to that. Let's talk about that.
So I have a couple of big moonshot ideas here, and I think we need that. I mean, I think it's pretty clear that, look, even if you sort of have some idea of what your health is, I'll put this in sort of technocratic terms first. The standard deviation of your death age is quite high, another way of saying that is you don't know how long you're going to live, and it's so you need some kind of insurance for the eventuality that you might live an unusually long period of time. I always think it's funny when you look at this financial planning software and it says, well, when are you going to pass away? Great. And then it fixes it forever. So if you're 62 and you say 90, okay, you only have whatever it is, 5% chance of reaching 90. By the time you're 75, right, this is contingent probability here. So your chance of reaching 90 is a lot higher than it was, and you haven't changed your plans. You haven't adjusted. So one moonshot idea would be to do what they do in Chile. I love what they do in Chile. They have, instead of minimum required distributions, they have maximum required distributions or maximum allowable distributions, and they force you to understand the actuarial loss, so to speak, that you have every year you age, right? Because every year you age, that money has to last longer than you would have planned the previous year. And so it's a declining pattern of withdrawals, even if you meet your return assumptions. People see this, and then they're given the option to have an indexed annuity, and lo and behold, 60% of the middle class in Chile choose an indexed annuity. Now, I don't think that's the right product allocation. I think you'd want to riff on this system a little, and I think people, you know, particularly since Social Security is quite robust here, it's not in Chile, you know, you'd want to have people saying, okay, I'll do like 30% towards an annuity or something. That's probably a better product allocation, depending on your particular needs. But I think that's the right idea to illustrate this. So that's one idea, is having some kind of change in what we let people take money out. It would send a signal that, like, this is how much you can live on. Another thing I'd like to see happen would be, look, if there aren't a lot of plain vanilla single premium immediate annuities or deferred income annuities, let's let people buy an annuity from the Social Security Administration. I acknowledge there's a bit of a moral hazard problem there. people already do this, right? They delay from 62 to 70. They're functionally buying an annuity. You could make an explicit transaction, and you could put it on much more actuarially fair terms for the government than we have right now, because the terms right now are fixed in statute, so it's an 8% increase every year after your normal retirement age, which in current interest rates is like a really good deal for an individual. It's a great deal, right? You could have a somewhat worse deal, but still a pretty good deal because it would have no loads. It would be simple. And as long as you dealt with the moral hazard problem, that is really healthy people doing this, unhealthy people avoiding it, and I think there are some ways to deal with that, then you would have a system where people were able to sort of, you know, buy an annuity, you know, maybe up to $100,000 or something like this. So maybe a $6,000 or $7,000 a year benefit. And that would really help. It would be synced up with the Social Security benefit. And if done correctly, it wouldn't hurt the trust fund. So those are a couple kind of like moonshot ideas. I think what we're talking about right now, and this is also maybe a moonshot, but what's sort of percolating is, why don't we have annuities built into qualified default investment alternatives so that you hit 55 and you get a sleeve that would buy a deferred income annuity? That takes away the longevity risk. You hit age 80, this annuity starts. Now, there's still inflation risk, but I think if those were QDIA, look.
So just explain what QDIA means.
Sure, So qualified default investment. So these would be the investments that you would automatically be defaulted into if you didn't make any other election.
Right.
That's led to the staggering growth of target date funds because people don't make a choice. They're put into a target date fund. It's a really good vehicle for accumulation. Well, why don't we extend that to decumulation? I think philosophically, we have to get past the point where, you know, look, this would not be liquid. So you'd need to change the law. And then you'd need to be putting people in an illiquid investment, and you need to figure out some way to make that portable from employer to employer. But that's another idea. That one probably has the most traction. The first two are like Aaron's ideas for improving things. That one's one that's gotten more traction and I think is potentially a good idea. I could keep going on about this. I'll give you one more.
Okay.
One more idea that you hear kind of kicked around are tontines. Sounds like a French pastry. It's not. And these would be products that – you know, the simplest version is, you know, the three of us decide that whoever lives the longest is going to, you know, keep all the money at the end, and we are all very good people, and we don't have an incentive to kill each other, which is, you know, where this always becomes a murder mystery story. You could design these in such a way that the mortality experience of the pool of people is judged against mortality expectations, and so the benefit fluctuates a little, sort of like a variable annuity, but without loads and based on the actual experience of a collective group of investors. So this is an idea that the Australians are trying to put in their retirement solutions, and it's sort of elegant, but I think it's I can see from the reaction from your face, it's very hard to sell to people. I mean, I think that's the toughest one. You know, I think the deferred income annuity, especially if it's already defaulted in, it's like the easiest thing to explain to people. When you turn 80, you're gonna get this cash flow, and so you don't have to worry so much. That's a lot easier than, okay, there's this pool of people, and then we're gonna judge the mortality experience based on the tape. I mean, that's pretty complicated, but there are a lot of wonky people who are very excited about the idea, and I have to confess I'm kind of one of them as well.
Do you think it's going to take a bear market to break the logjam on the Hill and actually get some of the more meaningful types of policy changes that we'd be looking for, or do you think that there's an actual prospect for lawmakers to come together and enact something that really makes a true difference in retirement security?
I'm not even sure a bear market would do it. I mean, what you'll see with a bear market is relaxing and suspending the RMD rules. So you've seen that before. But I mean, would it even lead to the kinds of – because the solutions are going to be so long term, right? I mean, you say like, well, we have a really big problem right this second. So we're going to fully realize the benefits of in 25 or 30 years. And the other thing is, because we deliver this policy through the tax code, you know, retirement expenditures, quote unquote, in the tax code are the second largest tax expenditure that we have, right behind healthcare. That includes all the defined benefit contributions, IRA, everything, right? So it gets very expensive to move things around on this. Mm-hmm. And you know, typically, assuming that a sustained bear market is also coincident with, or not coincident, concurrent with sort of an economic downturn, that's usually when you have people saying, probably incorrectly, but saying, hey, you know, we need to go on an austerity plan. Well, all of these retirement solutions or tweaks are going to cost money if we're going to deliver them through the tax code. And I don't see any way we're moving off that as the primary policy tool that we're using to promote retirement security. So, you know, I actually I'm not even sure that would do it. It might. I mean, but there are some headwinds there as well, unfortunately.
One thing, and this is smaller bore for sure, but one thing that we have talked about internally at Morningstar for years has been the tax treatment of mutual funds. And we've seen the dramatic uptake of passive products, ETFs in particular. ETFs are really eating traditional mutual fund, certainly active funds, lunch. And taxes are probably part of that. Can you talk about whether there's any appetite to reform mutual fund tax treatment?
Something I'm always surprised by that you think there would be, right? I mean, you would think that the sort of constituency of people who invest in mutual funds would be able to sort of make this case. And I think the reason there hasn't been is that 401ks, IRAs, HSAs, 529s have been so successful, and they're totally removed from this problem, which is that I, as a mutual fund investor, don't have control of when I realize distributions that are taxable. You know, and it would be great if we joined most of the rest of the world and said, you get to control when you take that capital gain. And I'd also observe this could be good for the government. I mean, I think it would reduce the sort of cognitive problems people have with picking a fund that might lead to these tax events. But you know, look, capital gains rates right now, even if you're in the top bracket, so you're in the 20% plus the 3.8 for the ACA surcharge, that's 23.8%. And that's historically pretty low, right? I mean, for a lot of our history, we were just at marginal tax rates for capital gains. And so, you know, it's entirely possible that in the future, if you let people control when they take the capital gain, they're going to wait. And it's possible that in the future, those rates will be higher. Certainly, there'll be more money to tax. Likely, there'll be more money to tax. And, you know, I think this is because, look, Congress uses a 10-year budget scoring window for all this stuff, and they don't want to give up that revenue over the 10 years because they have to offset it somewhere else. So, but I'm always surprised, you know, I mean, it seems like a no-brainer to me that we should do what most other countries do and just say, look, you get to control the taxable gain on this fund when you actually sell it. You know, especially given how arcane the ETF in-kind you know, swaps are that lead to this efficient tax treatment. I mean, this is like, it's not like this is a coherent policy that we've come up with and we've said what we really want to do is encourage you to hold active mutual funds inside your 401k, but passive ETFs outside of it. I mean, there's no rhyme or reason to this. It's just kind of all an artifact. And so, yeah, it would be a great thing to see change, and maybe someday there'll be some momentum there. But again, I think my only theory here is that the tax-shielded accounts are just so popular and so successful that people just aren't up in arms about it the way they might be otherwise.
I was curious whether you think there ought to be a policy response related to, let's call it advisor disclosure, particularly around fees. You know, it's somewhat tied into the topic of ETFs and passives. One of the things that we've seen is advisors have put their clients in passives and ETFs writ large, and they've done so in part because they want to reduce the internal expense of whatever it is they're building for the client. But then there's an entire other category of expenses, namely the fee that they're paid, that go largely unreported. Yes, of course, we have the ADV. But do you think that sort of the next phase in policymaking and attention will be increasing disclosure of advisor fees and sort of this constellation of other services that they provide?
I think it should be, yes. I think there should be a policy response there. Whether it will be or not is sort of separate, but you can't fix what you can't measure. If you can't define the problem, you can't address it. So we have all this great data on investment product fees, but yep, the ADV is a mess. I mean, if I go look at the ADV, it'll say, oh, I charge between 50 and 250 basis points, you know, depending. Great. I mean, so as sort of a policy analyst, I can't take that information and do anything all that coherent. I know there are people, you know, trying to really dig into it and see what they can tease out. And yeah, you're right. I mean, you're absolutely right. I mean, we've shifted from this model where, you know, the investment vehicle is almost, you know, it's almost like a commodity, and the what you're getting is the portfolio allocation and the advice from the advisor, and it's hard to measure. It's going to be very hard to see. You know, let's say that regulation best interest is working. How would we even know if we don't have these kind of measurements? And I go a step further. I mean, I think we need enhanced public facing disclosure, not you know, some fine print that's just given to an investor, but something that, you know, we and our competitors can synthesize, organize, make sense of on common kinds of conflicted payments. So we have great information on 12b1 fees and on load sharing, and those are the conflicts of the last decade. But we need to have information on sub TA and revenue sharing and technology fees. If we don't have that, and we don't, then I don't see how we can measure whether this system is working, whether things are getting in some ways, we're losing the ability to see if things are getting better or worse as that becomes the fee model. So I fully agree with the sort of premise of your question. We should be doing this. And that's something we recommended in our letter on regulation best interest. We thought it was just – they didn't ask about it, but we felt this was a good opportunity to raise it and something we'll continue to raise, you know, as they promulgate the final regulation.
Okay, Aaron, I think we could sit here and lob questions at you all day. Thank you so much for your time and your insights. We had a great time hearing from you today.
Oh, my pleasure. This is a lot of fun.
Okay, that's it for today. Thanks for listening. If you liked what you heard, please subscribe and rate The Long View from Morningstar on iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. You can follow us on Twitter at Christine_Benz.
And at SYouth1, which is SYouth and the number one.
Finally, we'd love to get your feedback. If you have a comment or a guest idea, please email us at thelongview@morningstar.com. Thanks so much.
This recording is for informational purposes only and should not be considered investment advice. Opinions expressed are as of the date of recording. Such opinions are subject to change. The views and opinions of guests on this program are not necessarily those of Morningstar Inc. and its affiliates. Morningstar and its affiliates are not affiliated with this guest or his or her business affiliates unless otherwise stated. Morningstar does not guarantee the accuracy or the completeness of the data presented herein. Jeff Patak is an employee of Morningstar Research Services, LLC. Morningstar Research Services is a subsidiary of Morningstar Inc. and is registered with and governed by the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission. Morningstar Research Services shall not be responsible for any trading decisions, damages, or other losses resulting from or related to the information, data analyses, or opinions or their use. Past performance is not a guarantee of future results. All investments are subject to investment risk, including possible loss of principal. Individuals should seriously consider if an investment is suitable for them by referencing their own financial position, investment objectives, and risk profile before making any investment decision.